an alien starship with an insatiable curiosity about Earth's science fiction and fantasy trivia. The crew, two hapless astronauts who have spent their lives immersed in strange new worlds of the imagination. Now, Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden roam the universe, trying to find the way home, seeking to define the A to Z of SFF.
It's really good to still be here and still talking spooky stuff. So I've got a great one for you. Let's talk about a really, really bleak and nasty and depressing one, shall we? Because, you know, we've had some light and fluffy stuff. What with Sword and the Sorcerer, that was really light and fluffy, wasn't it? And Light Force, that was bonkers and strange. But no, let's really finish on the high with the fantastic Larry Cohen's God Told Me To... Let's talk about that, shall we?
Yeah, let's talk about that. God Told Me To, released in 1976, also known as, in some territories, as Demon.
Demon. Well, I bet there are loads of films around the globe that are, in one territory or another, have been called Demon or something like that. But yeah, wow. God Told Me To, from the master of... New York exploitation, shall we say, Larry Cohen, probably best known for his brilliant Cue the Winged Serpent, the only film that I can think of off the top of my head that merges gritty New York police procedural with a winged mythical demon of Aztec mythology.
Oh, surely there must be dozens of those, Rob.
Really? You sure? Okay, fine.
not until the 24th century, I think.
Well,
kind of a bit of a thing, didn't it?
Yeah. There was that whole spate of them around the sort of 2450s. Okay, I'll resist the temptation to get you to name a few, and we'll move on and talk about God Told Me To, which is a very different box of rats, really, isn't it? It's a remarkable piece of work. Incredibly gritty, but at the same time incredibly thoughtful. And well, Clive, why don't you just quickly run us through the basic plot and the basic idea behind the film?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Essentially, the film starts out very much as a police procedural, mm-hmm. In the sort of New York cop vein. We have our lead. Is played by Tony Lo Bianco, probably best known for his role in the cult film The Honeymoon Killers, and also he's in The French Connection.
Mm-hmm.
So he is a Catholic NYPD detective, which is important to the plot. Peter Nicholas. So initially we find that there's a sniper terrorizing New York City, perched on a water tower, who just sort of starts randomly shooting pedestrians on the crowded streets below. He's confronted by Peter Nicholas, our hero, but before jumping to his death, the sniper tells Nicholas that God told him to commit the murders, and then jumps to his death.
Mm.
And this then it becomes a weird sort of spate of serial murders. Only, weirdly, they all seem to, the only link is that heretofore, you know, normal, quote unquote, citizens suddenly have been going on strange killing sprees, and at the end of it saying, "God told me to," as the reason behind their mania, you know. And it's quite a low budget film, which is probably why we get that gritty feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, Larry Cohen is very clever at sort of stretching his sort of production dollar to kind of make it feel bigger than it is. And it's interesting that whereas a lot of films, they sort of start smaller and get bigger, this one, it almost starts quite epic in terms of like the whole city, and then gets smaller and smaller and smaller and more claustrophobic.
Mm.
So we have his investigation, and there's also another key sort of happening in this Patrick's Day parade, where the director apparently Pope said that he was filming a documentary about the St. Patrick's Day parade to get the footage he needed, and he actually, this one of the other reasons why this is a cult film is that it features the first on-screen appearance of Andy Kaufman, the cult comedian, as a detective. He just basically dressed him up and got him to sort of march along in the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York, and got away with it. What they did is then back in, and then later on they sort of restage bits of the parade in a sort of much tighter focus to do the bits where people were being killed, obviously, because it wasn't going to disrupt the St. Patrick's Day parade by, you know, fake killing people in the middle of it.
Well,
it's very clever use of that, and it has that sort of 70s kind of thing, you know, going on.
Mm, very all the way through. I mean, as you say, Larry Cohen, very clever at. I guess these days you'd almost call him a run and gun kind of a filmmaker, in that he was very savvy about using location, about using what he could lay his hands on, and opportunities that arose. So, you know, things like that, St. Patrick's Day parade, just basically staging a little bit of a shooting and then running off before he got arrested. I mean, God only knows what would have happened if Andy Kaufman had pulled a gun during the St. Patrick's Day parade. That could have been fairly scary, to put it mildly.
Could have been, yeah. Peters continues his investigation, and he finds that the murder seemed to have been influenced by this new religious cult leader called Bernard Phillips, played by Richard Lynch.
Hey,
it's that man again, our friend from The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Oh, spooky SFF favorite, Richard Lynch.
Yeah. So he finally tracks him down, and after a brief meeting when it becomes clear that this Bernard Phillips character is strange, and this is where things start to take a turn into science fiction.
Mm. Peter's investigations sort of lead him kind of towards this cult member, but at the same point, there's kind of inference that the cult member has connections to a kind of UFO happening. Nicholas is basically invited by the cult to join them, specifically because Phillips actually wants them to do it. You know, he's very much in control of the whole situation, to the point where he can persuade cult members to kill themselves if they if they fail him in any particular way. So they'll throw themselves in front of trains and jump off buildings and things like that. But Phillips is very keen to have Peter Nicholas join them. And the reasons for that become gradually clearer and clearer as Nicholas realizes that he and Phillips are connected in increasingly intimate ways, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting subversion of the sort of detective criminal sort of trope of the, hey, they're two sides of the same coin. Mm. And you know, and or the idea that the villain somehow makes it extremely personal, and you know, so that you have this link between the, you know, the detective, this, whether it's the kind of Dirty Harry figure, or something a bit more you know, conventional, going up against this sort of arch villain, whereas. Yeah, in this case, it twists it and takes it into a sci-fi place, and also it brings in this sort of this thing of Peter's Catholicism, which becomes very interesting because we find out that that both characters were born as a result of a virgin birth.
Mm. But that virgin birth, to sort of bring in the science fictional aspect, actually came about as their mother was kidnapped by aliens 35 years previously and basically artificially inseminated. So it transpires that that both hero and villain, as it were, are brothers. And that they both have strange kind of alien powers, notably the power to infect people's minds and to get them to do what they want. So as Nicholas's investigation moves away from simply being this murder investigation into more of a sort of exploration of his own past and what he is, things take on this increasingly kind of weird, kind of febrile, kind of almost, it almost gets kind of Cronenbergian towards the end, I would have said, where you've got this sort of weird body horror stuff going on and this sort of questioning as to exactly what he is, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's almost like after this initial confrontation with Bernard Phillips, where he sees what he is, which is, and it's this really kind of strikingly photographed thing where he's almost, he has this sort of Christ-like appearance, Richard Lynch, in this film, but he's sort of, it's like, he's literally glowing with light. I mean, he cannot pass as like a normal human. He has this kind of godlike, if you like, coming out of him. Mm. And, you know, he has this power that he can just influence people. But, you know, rather than, you know, being a using this power to sort of spread love and joy, he uses it to spread his influence and power in a negative way. Mm. You know, to build up this cult of followers and to, you know, and to, you know, the intimation is that the reason he's getting people to kill himself was to get Peter to come to him. Mm. That this is all part of it. That this is all part of his plan, because the ultimate aim, we find out, is that he wants to propagate their species by having a child together, because he's actually a hermaphrodite.
Mm. I mean, I was mentioning Cronenberg earlier on, and that last final confrontation between the two just ends up. I'm kind of reminded of The Brood or something like that, where you have, you have Phillips who kind of almost does he kind of almost turn into the girlfriend in the end? Because he certainly suddenly seems to have sort of male and female aspects to his face.
Well, I think that was always the case, that he had this androgynous look. Mm. It's just we didn't necessarily get a very good close up look at him on the initial encounter, but he certainly has that kind of vaginal type opening on his body.
Yeah,
but which Well, the thing it reminded me of was the opening that that James Woods' character gets in his torso in video.
Oh, the slot. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. So there's definitely a bit of that, and as you say, there's a lot of, you know, sort of things like the Brood. Yeah, and you have this whole kind of sort of Catholic guilt thing playing out, where he has his current girlfriend who doesn't understand why they can't have children together, and that's gradually revealed to be part of, as a result of, his alien biology, and him and in deliberately repressing, whether, you know, initially unconsciously, you know, the fact he's basically able to sort of terminate any pregnancies at will, which is a very creepy idea. But and then you have his previous wife who he's separated from, but for reasons of Catholic guilt, won't divorce. And she seems to have, they have a very strange relationship. And then there's a deeply upsetting scene where he meets his birth mother, who is in an old people's home, paper, Sylvia Sidney. And initially she won't talk about the experience which led to him being born, but then she does. And then we get, Space 1999, don't we, Rob?
We do. It's a very weird, she's basically explaining in flashback about what's happened to her, and you know, you got the whole sort of a huge white light swooping down, and it sort of lifts her up and into the interior of the spaceship. And basically, again, talking about how Larry Cohen uses what he could get hold of at the time, somehow he managed to get hold of some kind of generic stills footage from Gerry Anderson's Space 1999, which he went ahead and used as kind of a setting for the interior of the alien spaceship, which if you're a fan of 1999, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners are, that moment will kind of strike you as a little bit nicely familiar, and but a weird kind of homage to the arch puppeteer and model making genius of Gerry Anderson. It's kind of there and then it's gone. So I'm guessing that Larry Cohen just kind of figured, no one in the of my sort of audience would necessarily recognise that.
Yeah, and he also treats the footage so it's not done completely straight. He's almost using it as like a back projection, and you get this very strange and disturbing scene where the younger version of his mother is kind of drawn up into this spaceship on her way back from the 1941 World's Fair, and forcibly impregnated with this alien child, and so you have this interesting thing of these two brothers, quote unquote, you know, they don't have the same mother, Earth mother, they have the same, you know, alien parentage, but one can pass as human and basically is sort of denying his heritage and is therefore sort of viewed as a bit of a failed experiment, and the other one can't pass as human and is fully on board with the sort of, you know, alien side of his nature, her nature, I guess we should say. So yeah, and it's this, and it becomes this very kind of, it ultimately just becomes about these two characters, and all the, you know, once we have, it's this thing of initially it's all about the mystery. Then we kind of have an answer to the mystery, and then it twists into this sci-fi sort of familial drama almost. But it seeds all these interesting and rather subversive ideas. The idea that that perhaps, you know, other avatar figures that have come down to Earth who've had, you know, miraculous powers to heal, raise people from the dead. And sort of celebrated as sons of God or prophets, that perhaps they were extraterrestrials. Or as a result of this extraterrestrial intervention.
Definitely. I mean, that's kind of, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a common trope in science fiction, but it's certainly something we see popping up and down. You know, even things like, say, Michael Moorcock's Behold the Man, where Christ turns out to be a time traveler who kind of fits the bill just because the actual Christ figure is just not fit for purpose. But yeah, I mean, this whole notion of gods being aliens is something that you see quite a lot in the 1970s as well, with things like
Eric von Daniken.
That's the stuff. Yeah.
Chariots
of the Gods, that kind of deal. So you've got quite a lot of that kicking around in around the sort of edges of 70s science fiction, and you can see Larry Cohen's kind of playing around with that kind of feel as well, and doing it really successfully, in that he kind of slips it in almost under the radar of you know, I don't think the audience that would have walked in to see God Told Me To necessarily expected the film that they ended up getting at the end. There's, as you say, Clive, it ends up being very, very different from where it started. It kind of jinks and turns and shifts around, and it really, really does sort of, it keeps sort of knocking you off your feet, and it keeps sort of destabilizing what you're expecting. And certainly that final sort of 2 minute ending where Nicholas kind of rebels against his upbringing and you know, ends up sort of killing his brother and being arrested, and that final delivery direct to camera sort of just gives the whole thing this really chilling air. It is it's an incredibly bleak and bleak, I think, is probably just the best way of putting it, really. A very bleak piece of science fiction.
It is. I mean, you know, I think we should probably point out that, you know, he's you know, not just sort of, you know, very good sort of low budget producer director Larry Cohen. You know, he had a very long career as a screenwriter, which started in the sort of late 50s and 60s in television. Mm. And as a part of that, he created the series The Invaders.
Ah, right.
And he wrote the lion's share of the episodes, like over 40 episodes. I mean, he also created Branded, which is a Western series. But you know, I think you can definitely get a bit of that sort of paranoia. See, you know, you can see that in something like this. And I find him a very interesting filmmaker. I mean, there's definitely a schlocky side to his filmmaking. You know, whether he's working in sort of the blaxploitation or the sort of straight up horror, the It's Alive films, or his more sort of sci-fi stuff. But you know, there's often they're often very sort of interesting subversive ideas at the hearts of his films. Things like, if you look at something like The Stuff, for instance. Which is this, you know, very like anti-consumerist, anti kind of advertising movie with some interesting sci-fi ideas. So, you know, there are lots of these kind of little sort of things going around. But this one, you know, it's a strange thing that almost sort of starts off feeling like it's in the same world as something like Mean Streets, but then it steps sideways into something completely different, you know. And I think it's very much anchored by a sort of a very strong lead performance by Tony LoBianco, who didn't get a lot of opportunity for lead roles, but which is rather a shame, I think, because he has, you know, he definitely had as the kind of, you know, intensity and sort of gravitas for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is a very strong performance, considering, you know, it does sort of walk this very crooked and twisty path, but he absolutely commits to it all the way through, and you do feel the sense of his suffering as he kind of realizes that his sense of faith is coming from a very, very strange place indeed. So Lobianca's performance is absolutely riveting, and I think the same again with a lot of the cast. I mean, you mentioned Sylvie Sidney earlier on as the mother. She's only really in it for that one scene, but she absolutely nails it. That sense of just being this completely, totally traumatized, lost figure who's just been her life's just been ruined and for a very long time. So those sort of performances do really sort of help to lift it away from this kind of schlockiness that could have been part of the storytelling and give it a much more serious edge.
Yeah, definitely. And also I think that there's quite an interesting score to the movie by Frank Cordell. I mean, interestingly, it was originally going to be scored by Bernard Herrmann. Who'd already scored It's Alive, interestingly, for Coen.
Wow.
But sadly, he died before production. So this is why the movie is dedicated to him. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, there's that little side story as well where Coen, after Herrmann died, Coen asked Miklos Rozsa to score the film, and Rozsa's turned it down, saying, "God told me not to." Cheers, man.
Nice. Yes, very nice.
Classy. So, let's wrap up by just, I think we can recommend this movie, can't we? It's not the cheeriest of views by any mean, but the way it starts off as one thing, turns into another thing, and then turns into another thing entirely at the end. The strength of the performances, the strength of the script, and just the sheer inventiveness that's going on throughout make it a really solid watch. We both came away from it feeling that what we'd seen was definitely worth our while. And personally, I think you guys out there in listenership land, wherever you are, whenever you are, would find it worthwhile.
I think definitely. It may not have the sort of fun rewatchability of Cue the Winged Serpent, but it's definitely, it's a cult film for a reason, and it really does pack a punch, and it's worth checking out. Just be prepared for a slightly dark, gritty ride.
Yeah, you might want to watch something cheerful afterwards. Okay then, Curiosity, are you happy with our run-through of Larry Cohen's bleak but brilliant God Told Me To?
Oh, guys, thank you so much. Yes, it's fantastic, isn't it? But oh, so bleak and oh, so moody. But oh, just so good as well. And oh, Tony Lobianca's just so good in it. And oh, we like the Christ figure as well. He's so much fun with his golden light spilling out everywhere. So much fun. So why don't we go and visit the planet of the godlike aliens? That'll be fun, won't it? And that's the end of our spooky SF everyone. We really hope you've enjoyed it, guys. And who knows, maybe this time next year we'll be back for more spooky SFF. Okay, right, starting up the engines. Okay, right, we'll see you next week. Right, see you later, guys. Right, bye!
God told me to podcast.
The A to Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickens and Clive Ashenden, with additional voice talents of Maria Thomas. Music and editing are by Daniil Hallow at the Creation Station of Cavishing, all the waveform you can eat. Do you want to know more? Search for the A to Z of SFF on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter, or check out www.theatozofff.com.